Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Wendy Murphy. She's the director of the Women's and Children's Advocacy Project at New England Law Boston, where she also teaches sexual violence law. In addition, she's an impact litigator specializing in the constitutional and civil rights of abused women and children. Her Twitter is at Wendy Murphy Law. The website for the Judicial Language Project is https://student.nest.edu/centers/CLSR_JLP.CFM. So you can re-listen to that to get it. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, thanks again for having me, Derek. I really enjoy being on your show. Can I make one correction to my Twitter? It's at W Murphy Law, not at Wendy Murphy Law, just at W Murphy Law.
Oh, great. So today, let's talk about the ERA. What is the Equal Rights Amendment, and can you give us a history going back to its very beginnings?
Yeah, sure. I'll give you a short one since we have, well over 100 years of actual energy and activism around the concept of giving women equality at the constitutional level in America. And I'll make it brief. Also, because there's so much going on now moving forward that I'm excited about, but I'm so glad you asked about the history because, and this is probably the most shocking fact of all for me as someone who's deeply involved. So few people even know what the ERA is. I jokingly ask people, in social situations, whether they think ERA stands for, earned run average or something else, and invariably they think earned run average, mostly the guys. And, you know, people who know what ERA means, politically off the cuff are usually much older because they were around when, the first wave, if you will, of ERA activism happened in the 70s. So let me go back to the very beginning. The very, very beginning, on this issue began in the late 1800s when the 14th Amendment was ratified. And that's because when the 14th Amendment was ratified and put into our Constitution after the Civil War, and it was one of the Civil War amendments that also abolished slavery and gave black men the right to vote, the 14th Amendment was part of the package of amendments that became law around that time. And women were very, very angry that the original proposed language of the 14th Amendment was going to expressly cover not only blacks, but also women. And that did not happen. It was very intentional, very deliberate that the 14th Amendment was ratified, well, was passed by Congress and ultimately ratified by the states, explicitly excluding women from protection, particularly with regard to the Equal Protection Clause. And that's important because, you know, if you ever have any kind of legal controversy and you're before a judge in any kind of courtroom, at a minimum, you want to believe and you have a right to expect that the treatment you get will be equal, on par with all other persons, and that you won't be subjected to second-class justice ever. And after the 14th Amendment was ratified, because women were excluded from equal protection in the 14th Amendment itself, the battle began. And the battle began only in the sense that women were really angry that they were intentionally excluded. But flash ahead, you know, another 40 years or so, it took a lot more energy before Alice Paul in 1923 actually crafted the first language for what we now know of as an Equal Rights Amendment for women. The language used back then, which was successfully proposed but never passed by Congress back in 1923, was slightly different than the language we have today, but it basically made the point that men shall be equal to women and vice versa, and it was just very simple, very obvious, very easy to understand, and it went nowhere. And not only didn't gain steam, a lot of things happened that took women's rights out of popular consciousness as an important issue. You know, the war and then the aftermath of the war, I think, just made women's rights much less relevant than they should have been. But things changed in the 60s, of course, with the civil rights era. Women, of course, were part of that. People often think about civil rights as applying only to racial minorities, and that is absolutely not the case. Civil rights have always encompassed all marginalized people, including, of course, African Americans, but also women and people of ethnic marginalized ethnic classes and religions and so forth. And that period of time, the 60s and the 70s, to some extent, you know, brought a light to shine on the struggles of all classes of people that were being mistreated in society and in courts. But women in particular were focused on just getting that baseline equality in place in the Constitution. And so the ERA was refiled and successfully it passed by Congress in 1972. Again, the language was a little bit different than what Alice Paul had proposed, and makes the simple point, and this is actually the plain language of what ERA says: equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. That's the language. That's what we're talking about. And it was passed by Congress in 1972 and sent to the states for ratification. For people who don't understand how we, or may not understand how we technically, according to the Constitution, have to follow certain procedures to change the Constitution, that's covered in what's called Article 5. Article 5 of the United States Constitution says that if Congress passes an amendment and sends it to the states for ratification, the amendment shall become law once three-fourths of the states ratify. So as soon as it left Congress in 1972 and was sent to the states to be ratified, there was a lot of enthusiasm and expectation that, of course, the Equal Rights Amendment would be supported by a sufficient number of states, and because who in their right mind would be opposed to women's equality? It's just such a grotesque idea that somebody would openly say, no, I really think women ought not to be equally protected under the law. But there was some opposition. And so although we got pretty quickly to 35 states, we needed 38. 38 states would be the necessary three-fourths. And we got quickly to 35, but then there was a deadline attached to the Equal Rights Amendment. That deadline was 7 years long initially, so it was set to expire in 1979. But in 1978, Congress extended the deadline another 3 years so that it would expire not until 1982. But that didn't change anything. We didn't get any more states to ratify between 79 and 82. And so in a sense, the hope failed in 1982 when we never made it past 35 states. Women gave up. Groups stopped fighting because everybody thought at that time the clock ran out. We only had a certain number of years to get the states to ratify. It didn't happen. And we're too tired to start over again. Let's just go to our different jurisdictions and start fighting for statutory rights. You know, let's try to get our state legislatures to do certain things to elevate women's status in society and work through the state lawmakers and to some extent through Congress on certain types of laws. And get what we can in a less than constitutional sense. And that worked for a long time in the sense that people did feel, you know, that there was still work to do, and they were many, many women's groups were working on very important pieces of legislation during the years 1982 to 1992. And then something very important happened in 1992 that changed everything. The states ratified what we now know as the 27th Amendment. It's our most recent amendment. The 27th Amendment, otherwise known as the Madison Amendment, was ratified by the 38th state in 1992. And it's an amendment that, simply put, constitutionalizes congressional pay raises. So it puts the whole process of pay raises in the Constitution, which is both a way of guaranteeing that Congress gets pay raises, but also it provides a mechanism for how that happens. And women's rights groups were beside themselves that the 27th Amendment was ratified because it had passed Congress 203 years earlier in 1789. And women were angry because their deadline was only a short 10 years. And they could not comprehend why something as frivolous as congressional pay raises would get 203 years to ratify, where something far more important to a healthy democracy, women's equality and equal protection of the law would be given such a short deadline of only 10 years. And that made so many women angry that they said, we're not going to start over on the ERA. We're going to keep going. We're going to assume that the clock has not run out, because there's no way the Constitution can work in this, in such an arbitrary manner, that one amendment gets 203 years and another amendment gets only 10. It's just too arbitrary to be constitutionally tolerable. So we started fighting somewhat after 1992. Women's groups started getting together and developed what's called the three-state strategy, and they started thinking about which states could they go to that had not yet ratified. Where did we have the best political hope for getting the states to vote, to make it a priority, and to actually vote on their ERA bills? And some of the states said, "Don't ask us, because as far as we know, that's a dead issue, and the deadline expired, and we're not going to get involved." Those were mostly states in the South, but there was an enormous amount of effort in Nevada, and in 2017, led by State Senator Pat Spearman, Nevada took up and ratified the Equal Rights Amendment. So they became the 36th state to ratify, and the momentum started to build from there. So the following year in Illinois, which was also an unratified state, so 2018, a lot of momentum started to grow in Illinois to become the 37th state, because really they were the only state in the North, aside from Missouri, that had not ratified. And Missouri is questionably North, partially North, I should say, politically speaking anyway. And so Illinois became the hotbed of energy, and a lot of groups, including the group that I work with, Equal Means Equal, just got on the ground and pressed the flesh and did what they could to raise awareness. And Illinois was a successful vote in 2018. So we made it to 37 states in 2018 when Illinois ratified. And then all the energy started turning toward, well, which state should be the last state? Because there were several choices. Utah was a possibility. Arizona was a possibility. Virginia and Florida were kind of up there as possibilities. But, we ultimately came to the decision that the only state that was really close, that was really close to politically being able to ratify the ERA, was Virginia. And last year, over the past several years, a lot of energy has been targeted in Virginia. And Virginia just did not do the right thing for year after year, usually because, this has been the past few years that I've been aware of what Virginia's been doing. They declined to ratify because of Republican leadership. They were a Republican majority body, in particularly in the House of Delegates, where some of the power, well, the people who were in power and had to make decisions about, for example, whether to even call the bill for a vote, were Republicans who were adamantly opposed to women's equality. So that was a struggle. And so the focus became, what can we do on the ground in Virginia in 2019? Because we only lost by one vote last year in Virginia. And the focus then became this November of 2019, what can we do on the ground in Virginia to overturn some of the key states, some of the key districts in terms of who the leadership was, and, what authority they had over ERA, and whether they were pro-ERA or anti-ERA. And we really focused on 10 seats and hoped to flip 10 seats. I'm sorry, needed to flip only 2 seats, wanted to flip 10, and we successfully flipped 8, and turned the Virginia legislature into a Democratic majority, not just a Democratic majority, which is one issue because, people think Democrats are more likely to support the ERA. That's generally true, though Republicans led the way in Illinois, and there are lots of good Republican supporters for ERA in Virginia. But in order to take the leadership and turn that over, we had to become a Democratic majority in Virginia so that a Democrat would have the authority to call the bill to the floor for a vote, which happened. So in November, the elections were successful. We now have the majority we need to guarantee that the bill will be called for vote in early 2020 when the Virginia legislature convenes. And we've already heard from the necessary people there that it's a done deal. It's going to be called. They have the votes. So basically everyone is in agreement that as soon as Virginia takes up the bill, they will become historically such an important moment, but they will become the 38th and final state necessary to give women equality in the United States of America, almost 100 years after it was first proposed by Alice Paul in 1923. Not inconsequentially, it happens to be the 100th anniversary of women winning the right to vote. So there's a lot of excitement about the significance of this year, 2020 being the year of not just the year of the woman, but the year of women finally becoming fully equal citizens in the United States.
So even when I was a kid, so I was a teenager in the 70s, and even then, and, you know, I was raised a fundamentalist Christian, and so fairly conservative in general, but even still, I never understood the anti-ERA argument. So can you make, and don't make a sort of version of their argument. What is the, if you firmly believe that this is a terrible idea, what would you be arguing?
Well, what I can tell you, was effective back in the 70s and the early 80s, when Phyllis Schlafly propped herself up as the leader of the anti-ERA movement. She was both a religious-based voice, but also a voice for the idea that if women became equal, they would lose certain female privileges. For example, there was, in some ways, and at that time, a presumption that the mother should win custody of children during divorce, and they would lose that privilege of having the presumptive parental status in divorce cases in court if men and women were equal. She also complained that women would have to go to war, and that women at that time had the privilege of not having to fight physically at wartime, and they couldn't be drafted and so forth. But she also thought, and she made the arguments at that time, that it would increase the risk of gay marriage. It would allow men and women to use the same bathroom. And what's funny is all of her arguments at that time, she said, if the ERA is passed, all these horrific things will happen to society. And what we know now is all these years have passed since 1972, and all of those things have already come to change in the law. I mean, you know, women are not legally presumed the better parent. Women do go to war. You know, we do use the same bathrooms and all of those things, and gay marriage is legal. And, you know, so all of those parade of horribles that she put out there that would be the guaranteed product of ERA came to be through other means. And so those arguments have all kind of fizzled. But the interesting question today is, what's left? Where can you actually find an argument against ERA? And, you know, what's the answer to the question? Equality for women is bad because it really isn't a blank that I can fill in without making fun of it, because there are no arguments that make any sense. And there are a couple of reasons why I say that. And I'll still tell you what I think some of the arguments are, but one is that it's not just about women, it's also about men. And men do suffer discrimination. It's not something that many people think about or that people think matters very much, but the point of equality based on sex is also to make sure that we just treat men and women the same in every way that we can think of. And, you know, for men, sometimes it's just the culture of masculinity that is so burdensome and that makes their lives more difficult. You know, you don't pass a law saying men should bear all the burdens of masculinity that's toxic and difficult in the world. You can't pass a law like that, but the upside for men is certainly going to be cultural liberation from the chains of really offensive ideas about how they're supposed to be and what being a man means. And I say that with all sincerity, that there are just huge numbers of men that are suffering because of the cultural disparities and how we just treat the sexes, which is produced by structured inequality in our legal system. It just is. It's not the only source, but it is legitimized by the fact that men and women start off as unequal at birth. And then the other thing about, you know, the argument that somehow equality is bad for women, it's no longer about whether women will lose privileges, because there are no female-based privileges anymore. There just aren't. There are lots of examples where women suffer horrendously because of sex, and that includes health insurance costs and even things like domestic violence and sexual assault. When enforced in courts, these kinds of laws are often subject to disparate and disproportionate maltreatment. It's much more difficult to prove the charges. Even if you do, the punishments are going to be much less than if the person stole your money. I mean, that's how blatant it is in our criminal justice system. If you're victimized because you are female, the punishment is going to be much, much lower than if you were victimized because the sky is blue, or you know, you're much more likely to see your the charges dismissed in a case that happens based on sex than a case that happens based on money. And you know, there's lots of data on this that if you steal my money, you're much more likely to go to prison than if you steal my bodily integrity by raping me or punching me, or even in some ways, you know, killing me. There are deep discounts given out when the victim is female because the punishments we give out in our criminal justice system are reflective of the value of the people being hurt. And because women are second-class citizens, so, when they're hurt, the punishments are always lower. And so, go ahead.
So wait a second. So, let's say that the ERA has been, is now the, what would that be, 28th Amendment? Whatever a number of amendment.
Yes,
it would be the 28th Amendment. And it's passed, and all the court cases are settled. Everything is completely done. And then, I don't understand how that would make it so a judge couldn't let off a rapist easily. So let's say that a man rapes a woman, he's caught, so there's no question of guilt, and then the judge says, ah, he's a good boy because he's, you know, he's a college student, you know, we've seen those cases.
Yeah.
So he does all that, and what remedy would the ERA then allow that is not available currently? I'm not making the connection between.
Yeah, no, I understand.
The ERA.
Yep. So here's the thing.
Go ahead.
Currently, I'll just give you a concrete example of why the discounts are the product of that baseline inequality. In many states, Massachusetts, where I am, is one, the hate crime statute that provides for enhanced punishments if you hurt a person in a criminal way because of who they are in society, based on race, religion, national origin, even transgender. If you hurt someone because of those categories, you get enhanced punishment. You get longer time behind bars. You get whatever your punishment is, you get extra punishment. The only category of people not included on the list is female, women, sex, gender. That is the only category missing. So that statute would become blatantly unconstitutional with ERA in place. It would not be legal to enact such a law, to exclude sex from equal protection of such a statute. And because they are currently missing, because women are currently missing from equality and equal protection under that statute, if you go to court and you've been beaten by a guy who's pounding the hell out of you and saying, you're a bitch and I'm killing you because you're a woman and I hate you because you're female and I'm going to kill you because you're, you know, a bad woman, he can do anything to you because you're female. And that extra punishment statute will never kick in. If he does exactly the same thing to you while saying, I'm killing you because you're Jewish, I'm punching you because you're Jewish, I want you to die because you're Jewish, exactly the same behavior, exactly the same language, switch out the word Jewish for female, or female for Jewish, you get incredibly longer punishment, mandatory time actually behind bars. That's an example. That's a concrete example of what I'm talking about, that you shouldn't get an easier time behind, you shouldn't get easier punishment or feel like it's less terrible to beat the hell out of a woman because she's female than to beat the hell out of a Jewish person because they're Jewish. But that is the law in most states. And it's illegal only if ERA is passed.
So and in Virginia next year. And before we started recording, you said that there would be some interesting court challenges and some struggles there. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, there's no question. The minute Virginia ratifies, we are going to see cases in court raising important questions that are focused on this question of the deadline. And especially in the unratified states in the South, you're going to see some legal action by them. Literally, state officials going into some kind of lawsuit to declare the ERA invalid on the grounds that the deadline is valid. And there are going to be other lawsuits filed in the ratified states in the North arguing the opposite, asking court to declare the ERA valid on the grounds that the deadline is invalid. And in some ways, if you look at the map of which states have ratified and which have not, it's situated as a kind of civil war for women. It's a North versus the South fight. And I don't mean that in a literal sense of the way slavery was a North-South fight, but the breakdown in terms of the ideology of the Southern states being deeply anti-equality for women and the Northern states being kind of deeply angry that there's even a debate about this. It's such an intense fight that I think it is a bit of a civil war-like moment in time for us, because most people don't know much about the ERA, and even if they do, they don't understand that the tension in terms of which states have ratified and which haven't is drawn along this North-South line, which, by the way, is very different from suffrage. When women were trying to ratify the right to vote, the dividing line was more east to west than it was north to south, because the country was still growing and there was a different political landscape. But for the ERA right now, there is this north-south tension, which is unfortunate, because an awful lot of good people in the South do support ERA, but those states remain unratified and fiercely unratified. The other areas of tension that are going to come up in the courts in particular will be whether there should be deadlines at all. Because this is a sort of federal government versus states' rights debate. When Article 5 was made part of the Constitution, the plan was to give the federal government and the state equal authority in deciding when our Constitution needed amending and under what conditions and so forth. They were supposed to have equal authority in making that very important, very somber decision. But when the Congress started attaching deadlines to how much time the states could have to ratify, you could almost see how that, without even waiting for it to happen, you could see how that would completely tip the balance in favor of the national government and against the states, and against the power of the people, frankly, to have an important role in making this decision. Because if Congress feels like giving a long deadline to one amendment and a really short deadline to another, they're obviously going to have complete control over whether an amendment ever has any hope of becoming law with regard to the ratification piece. And that's actually, that's on display when you look at what happened with the Madison Amendment. Of course, Congress wanted to constitutionalize its pay raises, so it was only too happy to validate the ratification of the 27th Amendment, even though there was a 203-year delay from the time it passed Congress to the time the states ratified. That was not only pretty outrageous when you think about it because of how long 203 years is, but it also conflicts with an existing Supreme Court case from 1921 called Dillon versus Gloss, where the Supreme Court was discussing this idea of Congress imposing deadlines. You could tell they were very uncomfortable with the idea, but they said, well, okay, if we're going to let Congress impose deadlines, but they have to be reasonable. And we don't know what reasonable means. We're not going to say it's 5 years or 20 years. We're just going to say it has to be reasonable and leave it to Congress to figure that out. However, they dropped a footnote. The Supreme Court dropped a footnote in that 1921 case and said, we don't know what reasonable means, but we know that some amendments are already much too old to ratify. For example, and they cite the Madison Amendment. So here's the Supreme Court in 1921. Saying that the Madison Amendment, which had passed Congress in 1789, was already far too old to ratify. Nonetheless, in 1992, many, many years later, the amendment gets ratified, and the Congress takes it upon itself to declare the amendment valid, which it also doesn't really have authority to do. Only the courts can declare what the Constitution means and whether something is, in fact, constitutional. But you know, you have this almost arrogance on the part of Congress accepting the Madison Amendment as valid despite the 203-year delay. Then you look at what it was. It was a congressional pay raise issue, which is so not worthy of the seriousness of constitutional lawmaking. And contrast that with the 10 years that women's equality got, you know, well, that's going to be a big argument in the courts. We're going to be saying in the northern courts, where we're going to be filing lawsuits with Equal Means Equal, that the Constitution cannot be so frivolous about such something so important, where one amendment gets 203 years and another gets 10. But even more to the point is that although the Dillon case said Congress can add deadlines if they want to, the court made it with the caveat that they can't be unreasonably long. And they pointed to the Madison Amendment as an example of one that was already too old to ratify. And yet Congress basically thumbed its nose at the Supreme Court of the United States in 1992 when it validated the Madison Amendment. So we're arguing the Dillon case really doesn't give Congress anything anymore. That case has kind of been voided by what Congress did. Congress so disrespected what the Supreme Court said in 1921 that case really has to be reconsidered and kind of rethought from the beginning. And so the Dillon case is the only real case on point that even speaks to this issue of can Congress impose deadlines. And we think that it's 100 years later, the case is a little old anyway to be that reliable because the world has changed. The country has changed in 100 years. And we think the Supreme Court of the United States will welcome the opportunity to take another look at this question and really think hard about whether they made the right choice in 1921 to let Congress set deadlines, given how Congress disrespected the power that it was granted by the Supreme Court when it validated the ratification of the Madison Amendment. It's time to start from scratch, is my point, and really ask the Supreme Court of the United States eventually, and certainly the courts in the North when we start out, how do we better strike a balance between the national government and the states to make sure that the Congress doesn't seize complete control over the amendatory process by arbitrarily setting deadlines that enable some amendments to become ratified and prohibit that from happening with others.
So this is kind of off topic, but I'm really curious, are there other significant amendments that have been reasonably close to passing that have timed out before? ERA pretty much the only one?
Well, let me say this. The answer is there are so few amendments with deadlines that's not even really the focus. The vast majority of amendments never had any deadlines at all. I'm sorry?
I said that's a crock that they put one on this one, but not on most of them.
Yeah, well, it's. I think it started with Prohibition. I could be wrong. It was around the time of Prohibition. And there have been lots of scholars, pointing out that the beginning of this idea of attaching deadlines was really meant to politicize the amendatory process. And that's another reason that we're going to fight so hard to call attention to how wrong it is to have deadlines. The last thing you want to do when you're doing something as serious as amending the Constitution is subject it to the political shenanigans, if you will, of regular lawmaking. But that's what the deadline facilitated. And with Prohibition, that also got a 7-year deadline. But that was designed to ensure its ratification because those who wanted it to pass were okay spending the gobs and gobs of money that they wanted to spend to get it ratified quickly and not having it drag out, where had there been more, more thought and more deliberation, Prohibition never would have passed because, as we know, it was rescinded by a different amendment not too long after. So there was always suspicion that the deadline was designed to encourage corruption facilitate political shenanigans and force the hand of the states from a, you know, from a financial corruption perspective, force the hand of the states rather than letting the states take the time they need to decide whether they actually support something or not. So prohibition, it was kind of a, you know, a heavy-handed push on the states that very quickly the states, I think, regretted the result, and that's why we ended up with another amendment to remove it. But even that, people kind of raised their eyebrows about what is prohibition doing in the Constitution? That's kind of like congressional pay raises. That's not the sort of thing that needs to be constitutionalized. That's, you might want to make a federal law about it. You certainly might want to make state laws about it, but at the statutory level, not the constitutional level. So, you know, I think the Supreme Court of the United States has not had a lot of opportunity to address these really important questions about not only the federal government and the nature of federalism generally, as it, especially as it applies to this question of states having equal authority to decide how the Constitution gets amended, if at all, but also the battle between the judicial branch and the legislative branch, because remember I said a few minutes ago it was Congress that quote-unquote validated the 27th Amendment's ratification in 1992. The Supreme Court of the United States, I'm sure, found that curious, because the judicial branch of government decides whether something is constitutional, not the legislative branch, and yet Congress has kind of, in my opinion, overstepped its bounds by a lot of the things it's been doing in the recent past with regard to both, you know, especially the Madison Amendment, but even with ERA, dictating how and when the Constitution gets amended. It should be the judicial branch of government that ultimately decides what the Constitution means, what Article 5 means. And on this question, on this issue, the question we're going to be raising with the courts is not only whether it makes sense to let Congress impose deadlines because of the potential for corruption and politicization, but also, what about just a strict constructionist read of Article 5? Article 5 says nothing about deadlines at all. It just says when three-fourths of the states ratify, it's done. So if it, you know, if you really want to be a strict constructionist, which this current Supreme Court is, and, you know, the notion of this being a conservative idea sort of works to women's advantage, we're going to say follow Article 5 strictly. It says nothing about deadlines. Don't give Congress the power to impose deadlines. Because, again, this ought to be a balance of power, and it ought to be the judicial branch of government that decides what Article 5 means, not Congress, and yet Congress has been running around dictating how amendments work and so forth since 1992, probably since before 1992, but it's really time, I guess, is the point, for the judicial branch, for the courts to step up and say, we need to clarify a bunch of stuff, and the Equal Rights Amendment, the interesting issues about the Equal Rights Amendment's deadline give us the opportunity to do that. And I think, you know, one of the funny parts about how this is all going to play out is that women's rights groups are going to be making some pretty conservative arguments about why the ERA is valid, including that Article 5 ought to be strictly construed, that states' rights ought to prevail and not the national government in terms of dictating when an amendment is valid. And we don't care. You know, we're happy to take on whatever argument works because we've got to get this done. And in my opinion, if we end up in front of courts, including the United States Supreme Court, making conservative arguments about what many see as a very progressive idea, then isn't that a strong argument in favor of why we ought to prevail? Because it suggests that doing the right thing on ERA will make both sides very happy.
So we have, thank you for all that, and we have about 4 or 5 minutes left, and is there anything you want to say about either the ERA or the struggle to make it a constitutional amendment successful? What else do you want to say about it?
Well, I guess the only thing that I think is also worth mentioning, there's so much to these arguments. It's tough stuff. This constitutional stuff, especially for issues that are barely ever addressed by the Supreme Court, it makes it hard because it's almost like a law school exam, what we're going to be arguing in court about all of this. But we do, you know, we do need more unity. And I say this, with great respect to some of the, even the women's groups that aren't necessarily on board with this idea of going to court and trying to win in the courts and, to make this rather conservative argument, frankly, that, Congress oughtn't have the power to impose deadlines. Women are not in solidarity on this. There are some groups that would like to start over, unfortunately. There are some groups that are not supporting the ERA while pretending to support women's rights. I'll give you a couple examples. Time's Up, you know, a very well-known national movement that spends millions and millions of dollars doing what they claim to be women's rights work and women's equality work. They will not support the Equal Rights Amendment, and I find that very disturbing. It makes me very nervous about whether, you know, whether we've reached a stage in women's rights activism where there's been so much co-optation and corruption that even the seemingly good groups are actually working surreptitiously or covertly, or I don't even know if that's the right word, but they're working in ways that are, that don't appear to be hurtful to the cause, but they're doing things to hurt the cause. Because from where I sit, nothing matters at all until you have equality in the constitutional baseline. You can fight for equal pay laws all day long. When you go to court to enforce them, if you don't have equality in the Constitution, you won't get equal pay. Even if the equal pay statute says equal pay is guaranteed, if you can't go into court as a fully equal person entitled to equal enforcement and equal protection of the law, you're not ever going to get equal pay. It's not possible. So anyone who's wasting their time talking about let's go to the legislature and pass a law and ask for equal this and equal that and pregnancy and, you know, health care and all these issues that are uniquely hurtful to females, if you don't demand equality first, everything else second, you are actually working against the interests of women. And it's awkward to say that because it's hard to look at a group like Time's Up and say, you need to stop what you're doing. You're hurting women's rights. But they are. They're hurting women's rights because they're distracting our attention away from the only issue that matters, equality in the Constitution. Equality first, everything else second. And if you're not saying that, if that's not the work that you're doing, you're undermining all rights for all women.
Well, thank you so much for all of your work in the world, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Wendy Murphy. This is Derek Gent for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.